On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The latest intercontinental IT book out of India hits America this month with the 900-plus pages of Vikram Chandra's big novel, Sacred Games. HarperCollins won the U.S. bidding war with a $1 million advance on a sprawling saga of life and death in the underworld of Mumbai, Bombay. A police inspector and a maximum gangster square off on apocalypse and the meaning of life. Critics say Sacred Games is where Crime and Punishment meets The Godfather with The Sopranos' irony and a Bollywood beat. Vikram Chandra should know. His life these days is half Mumbai, half California, and all about the book. Joining me now from San Francisco is Vikram Chandra. Chandra comes from a Bollywood family with deep ties in the Indian movie business. He wrote Red Earth and Pouring Rain and Love and Longing in Bombay. He married an American a year ago, lives in Mumbai and Berkeley, teaches at University of California at Berkeley. His new book of gangsters, cops, Bollywood, and a rich and brutal tapestry of life in Mumbai is Sacred Games. Vikram Chandra, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a great big book, 900 pages and all kinds of action, but give us the heart of the narrative line. What's going on here?
At the beginning, a police inspector, Sartaj Singh, is given an anonymous tip that a very famous gangster, Ganesh Gaitonde, is hiding out at a certain spot in the city. So Sartaj, of course, gets a party together and goes running off trying to capture him. He gets there and finds that the gangster has barricaded himself inside this house. And so they start having this very strange conversation over the intercom. Sartaj finally manages to break the door down and goes in and finds that Gaitonde, the gangster, has shot himself in the head and killed himself. And from then on, the narrative moves in two parallel tracks, more or less, one being Sartaj trying to figure out what this man, Ganesh Gaitonde, was doing back in Bombay, why he killed himself, who the woman is who is also dead, who is in this house with him. And the other is Ganesh Gaitonde still talking, telling us the story of his rise from the footpaths of Bombay to a position of preeminence. He heads a criminal empire, organized crime gang, which is called the G Company. These gangs are called companies in Bombay. Mm.
Still talking, in that case, from beyond the grave and 900 pages, wilder and wilder with all kinds of inset stories woven through. Paul Gray in the New York Times said, you know, you're paying homage here to both Ian Fleming and James Joyce, a kind of a Finnegan's Wake quality at some points here. He says it may be difficult to have it both ways. What do you think? Can you? What are you shooting at? I mean, there's a gangster story here, the Godfather business, but there's a lot more at the same time. How do you describe your ambition for the book, Vikram Chandra?
Well, I think we should remember that the detective story was actually invented by a literary man, Edgar Allan Poe. I guess personally, I find the distinction between high and low culture, between genre and literary fiction, one that is more harmful than useful most of the time. What I was trying to do was to catch the sense of how the lives of ordinary people are caught up within a much larger web, as it were, of events and forces. When I started thinking about the book, at that point I imagined that it was going to be more or less a conventional policier with a body or a dead body or two on the first page, and then 300 pages later it would all be neatly wrapped up with a solution. And then as I started investigating, as I started actually talking to people who knew about organized crime, who were in it, the police, it became clear that the connections spread out in all directions. So that, of course, obviously, organized crime is connected to local politics. But if you're talking about local politics in India today, and I think actually everywhere in the world, you're also talking about religion. And all of these things intersect at some point in the world we live in today with media, with show business, television, film. And then in a larger sense, this is all held within the context of what is traditionally called the great game, the struggle between nation states in the subcontinent for power and dominance, and very directly in the sense that some of these organized crime gangs have are used by the local intelligence agencies as extra-constitutional arms.
So a great big structure blows up off the beginning of that simple detective story, but I'd love to get some of the flavor of that in our ears.
Sure.
As we go ahead here, Vikram, there's a reading early on where it's still fairly straight-ahead detective work. Here's your police inspector, Sartaj Singh, sort of out doing his business. Could you set this up and read a bit for us?
Sure. Sartaj has just been told that there's a murder case in a very poor part of the city, in a slum. And they've just gone in and found the location of the murder. Mm. The dead man's father was waiting for them at the edge of Navnagar, below the gentle slope covered from Nala to road with hovels. He was small and nondescript, a man who had spent a lifetime effacing himself. Sartaj stepped after him through the uneven lanes. Although they were going up the slope, Sartaj had a feel of descent. Everything was smaller, closer, the pathways narrow between the uneven walls of cardboard and cloth and wood, the tumbling roofs covered with plastic. They were well into the Bengali Bura, which was the very poorest part of Navnagar. Most of the shacks were less than a man's standing height, and the citizens of the Bengali Bura sat in their doorways, tattered and ragged, and the barefooted children ran before the police party. On Katikar's face, there was furious contempt for Jhopatpatti dwellers who let dirt and filth and garbage pile up not 2 feet from their own doors, who let their little daughters squat to make a mess exactly where their sons played. "These are the people who ruin Mumbai," he had often said to Sartaj. "These gamars who come from Bihar or Andhra or Bangladesh and live like animals here." These were indeed from Bangladesh, Sartaj thought, though they all no doubt had papers that said that they were from Bengal, that each was an Indian citizen. Anyway, there was nowhere in their watery delta to send them back to, not a half biga of land that was theirs that would hold them all. They came in their thousands to work as servants and on the roads and on the construction sites, and one of them was dead here. He had fallen across a doorway, chest inside, feet splayed out. He was young, not yet out of his teens. He wore expensive kids, good jeans, and a blue collarless shirt. The forearms were slashed deep to the bone, which was common in assaults with choppers, when the victim typically tried to ward off the cuts. The cuts were clean and deeper at one end than the other. The left hand had only a small oozing stump where the little finger had been, and Sartaj knew that there was no use looking for it. There were rats about. Inside the shack, it was hard to see, hard to make out anything through the buzzing darkness. Katikar clicked on an ever-ready torch, and in the circle of light, Sartaj flapped the flies away. There were cuts on the chest and forehead, and a good strong one had gone nearly through the neck. He might already have been walking dead from the other wounds, but that one had killed him, dropped him down with a thud. The floor was dark, wet mud. "Name," Sartaj said. "Hisab," the father said. He was facing away from the door, trying not to look at his son. "Yes, Shamsul Shah."
Shamsul Shah, Vikram Chandra, reading from his big new novel, Sacred Games. And they're taking us right into the detective work of Bombay, the underside of that big city, Mumbai. Vikram Chandra, it's hardly the kind of community that you describe right there, that kind of neighborhood, hardly where you began. What was it like for you as a, I guess you're New Delhi-born, but spent a lot of time in Mumbai now, to go out and figure this out? Is it a part of town that an Indian like yourself would automatically understand, or did you have to go on a kind of learning curve to know what went on in the shanty towns of Mumbai?
Well, the interesting thing about a town like Bombay is that the two or communities like this aren't actually very separated from each other. It's a very dense city, so that right next to the most expensive real estate, literally next door to it, you'll have a slum. And so all kinds of people have to negotiate each other's existence every day, which doesn't mean there's not separation. And so I did spend a lot of time on my feet, walking through areas that I didn't know much about, talking to people. And my effort was mainly, I guess you could call it research, but for a fiction writer, it's not as directed as the word research makes it sound. My intention most of the time was to go and sit in a room with somebody and try to get them to talk about their lives and keep my mouth shut. And at some point, the person stops actually telling you a story, and they're more or less trying to explain themselves to themselves. And that's when you get the most interesting revelations as they try and figure out who they are and how they've become who they are.
Do Americans have half an idea of what Mumbai is these days? I mean, you had to go out to do some immersion. On this side of the planet, do Americans know what on earth is going on there?
Well, I think just as an Indian reading a novel about New York, there are certain things that you won't get. You know, there's a whole universe of cultural reference and language that you don't understand.
And you've actually got a big glossary at the back of this book, lots of Hindi and a bunch more here.
Right, right.
Vikram Chandra, I wish you'd introduce the main protagonist for us in a little more depth here. Sartaj Singh, the police inspector, has appeared in your work before. Give us a sense of this policeman in this contemporary Mumbai setting.
He actually showed up in a story called Kama in my last book, which is called Love and Longing in Bombay. Mm. In that story, he's going through a very painful divorce and investigating a murder having to do with love and loyalty and so forth. When he shows up in this book, it's several years later. He's past 40. He's resigned himself to a kind of middling career. And also his integrity, as it were, has been worn down by the enormous spread of corruption that he swims in. In other words, to survive, he takes bribes. He compromises with this culture that surrounds him. Although he tries every day to make 1,000 little moral decisions about what he would, the kind of corruption that he will participate in and the kind that he will not. And he still has within him, I think, some sense of honor that makes it painful for him at times to be doing this. But he himself thinks of this as a kind of silly romanticism.
We'll look at the villain that he's up against, kind of almost lovingly portrayed here, Ganesh Gaitonde. But maybe on Sartaj, it would be good to hear you read some of your description of him as he deals with that awkward situation. He's out of this marriage now to a woman who had a lot of money. He's living as a policeman on a policeman's salary and finding his morals under some pressure. Could you read a bit from Sacred Games for us, Vikram Chandra?
Sure. This is Sartaj at the end of a normal day of policing. He's at home now. At 11, Sartaj stood under a pounding stream of cold water, his face held up to it. The pressure in the pipes was very good, so he lingered under the shower, moving the sting from one shoulder to the other. He was thinking, despite himself and the rush of water in his ears, about Kamble and money. When Sartaj had been married, he had taken a certain pride in never accepting cash. But after the divorce, he had realized how much Megha's money had protected him from the world, from the necessities of the streets he lived in. A 900-rupee monthly transportation allowance hardly paid for 3 days of fuel for his motorcycle, and off the many notes he dropped into the hands of informants every day, maybe one or two came from his minuscule Khabri allowance, and there was nothing left for the investigation of a young man's death in Navnagar. So Sartaj took cash now and was grateful for it. Sala Sardar is no longer the Sala of rich bastards, so he's woken up. He knew the officers and men said this with satisfaction, and they were right. He had woken up. He took a breath and moved his head so that the solid thrust at the center of the flow pummeled him between the eyes. The lashing noise of it filled his head. Outside, in his drawing room, it was very quiet. That there was no sleep yet, however tired he was, and despite his yearning for it, he knew. He lay on his sofa with a bottle of Royal Challenge whiskey and one of water on the table next to him. He drank in accurate little sips, timed regularly. He allowed himself 2 tall glasses at the end of working days and had been resisting the urge recently to go to 3. He lay with his head away from the window so he could watch the sky, lit still by the city. To the left was a long gray sliver, the building next door, turned by the window frame into a crenellated abstraction, and to the right what was called darkness, what disintegrated softly under the eye into an amorphous and relentless yellow illumination. Sartaj knew where it came from, what made it, but as always he was awed by it. He remembered playing cricket on a Dadar street, the fast pock of the tennis ball and the faces of friends, and the feeling that he could hold the whole city in his heart from Colaba to Bandra. Now it was too vast, escaped from him, each family adding to the next and the next until there was that cool and endless glow, impossible to know or escape. Had it really existed, that small, empty street, clean for the children's cricket games and Dabba Ice Spice and Tikkar Birla, or had he stolen it from some grainy black-and-white footage, given it to himself in gift, this memory of a happier place?
Mm. Vikram Chandra reading from his new novel, Sacred Games. You can see more from the novel, read more at our website, onpointradio.org. Sanjay's calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Sanjay. You're on the air with Vikram Chandra.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just a couple of questions for Vikram. First of all, your book sounds fascinating. I'm just waiting to read it. Read your other books and really like them. I have two
Thank
questions.
You.
One is there's a particular kind of writing that has evolved about India now, which kind of exoticizes a place like Bombay. And I don't want to name authors, but really it looks at it and almost presents it to a Western audience as if it's this shining kind of jewel, covered in grime and dirt that you have to present to a Western audience. And I hope you haven't done that, but I'd like to hear what you have to say about that. And the other thing is that much Indian writing actually refuses to face up to the fact that places like Bombay have deeply split personalities. Class is such a huge factor.
Right.
And I am not entirely sure how it's fully addressed in, Indian novels, Indian cinema. I was just curious to know what you had to say about that.
Big topics both, Sanjay, and thanks for them. Vikram, maybe first to this issue of exoticizing Indian culture. You're writing in the Boston Review, I think it's in the current issue, about authenticity and or recently, about authenticity, the debate over authenticity and whether it's you can sit in Berkeley and write about the home country and not be tempted to become a kind of, orientalist of your own homeland. You reject that. What do you say?
Well, I think we have to be careful about how we make these judgments about what is exoticizing and what is not. Because often what writers and artists will do will take a detail and lovingly embrace it, caress it, as it were. So often what happens is that for instance, if an Indian writer has a mina bird on the first page of her novel, somebody will accuse her of exoticizing, right? Or if somebody else has Ganesh in a story, somebody will say, the elephant-headed god.
Mm-hmm.
The trouble is that there are minas in India, and if I walk down a street in Bombay any day, you'll see 100 Ganeshas in the shopkeepers right at the front of the shop. So the trouble with always positing ourselves as resisting the West, a monolithic West, is that we again then paint ourselves into a corner where we are always restricting ourselves to being able to talk about only certain things or to use certain things.
Mm.
So that it seems to me a much more interesting way to approach this is that if there is indeed a cliche that has been put about, that's become worn out, what's more interesting to do is to try and re-inhabit that and make it come alive. And take it away from the people that maybe have utilized it for their own ends. I'm not arguing that Sanjay's point was wrong at all, but I'm saying that maybe we need to complicate the discussion a bit. Finally, I think maybe the distinction that we should be making is between bad writing and good writing. A really good artist, a really good writer will make even the familiar seem unfamiliar once again.
You know, in the time of Vikram Chandra and Salman Rushdie and Arundhati Roy and Jhumpa Lahiri and Vikram Seth and Kiran Desai and all these, it may be worth reading a little bit of your own kind of manifesto on this back. This is from the Boston Review. You say, my brothers and sisters who are artists, I say, ignore the commissars. Use whatever you need. Swagger confidently through all the world because it all belongs to you, and don't worry about tradition. You write, Vikram Chandra, to be self-consciously anti-exotic is also to be trapped, to be censored. Be free, give up nothing. In your work, don't be afraid of elephants and snakes and mystical India. India is full of elephants and snakes and mysticism. Don't fear the god of authenticity, you write, for he is a weak god, a fraud, a fake. We may say more on that, but what about the split personality issue that Sanjay raises from Toronto? I mean, you see it in Bombay. It's there in India now for all the world to see, kind of richest and most cutting edge on any front, and also the most ancient and often poverty-stricken. It's almost a cliche when it comes to India, and yet you don't get away from it in sacred games.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's especially when you're talking about this city, the paradox of incomprehensible wealth next to the most debilitating and oppressive poverty is something that you really can't ignore. So that the kind of area that Sartaj just was investigating the murder in lives cheek by jowl next to a very expensive restaurant where people spend, you know, somebody else's monthly wages on one dinner. Mm. And I think that's part of the paradox of modern India today, that there is this economic boom. We are being promised 10% growth this coming year. And yet there are hundreds of millions of people who don't have clean drinking water, who don't have access to basic medical care. And so I think we live in what the Chinese call very interesting times. And if we don't do this very carefully, if we cannot take the rest of the people along with that growing middle class, you're going to end up with very, very explosive repercussions. Towards the end of the novel, there's the story of another young man who ends up in Bombay, and he's an educated young man who grows up in Bihar, but because of the resistance that's put up in front of him, the feudal kind of structure that prevents him from living with dignity, he joins the Leninist Maoist guerrillas known as Naxalites. And, you know, that guerrilla movement extends itself in a huge swath right across India, from the very north, from Nepal through UP and right into Maharashtra near Bombay. Mm-hmm. So all of those exist at the same time. And the detective story or the police novel is a particularly efficient way, I think, of exploring these contradictions. Traditionally, the Nora story, for instance, you know, you start off with the dead body of the common person at the beginning of the story. And then as the detective uncovers the connections, you find out, of course, that it's connected all the way to the very top. Mm-hmm.
The mayor, and the governor, the president,
the mogul, exactly. So what this lets you do is actually look at all parts of a culture at a given time and place. And Sacred Games, I guess, also because it is a many-stranded story, I hope captures all of those various facets of a changing culture.
We're going to follow some more of those strands. We've got a little bit of Crime and Punishment, a little bit of The Godfather here. Ian Fleming, James Joyce, Nasser's calling from Boston. Hi, Nasser, you're on the air.
Hello, Vikram. How are you?
Hi.
I give you some information so that you can answer the question. I'm a Muslim from Lahore. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, there was a few years back, there were stories in the New York Times, persistently, there were several gangsters, Muslim gangsters, who were living or hiding in Bahrain and Middle Eastern countries, and they were actually behind blowing up some public buildings. Did you do any kind of background work on that? And if that part of link ever came into your story?
Nasser from Lahore, from Pakistan, wants to know. Vikram Chandra.
Yes. Well, I think traditionally the underworld has been a particularly secular place where all religions, all castes, all kinds of people have worked together. I think after the religious schisms and troubles of the 80s and 90s in India, with the rise of the Hindu religious right and the destruction of the Babri Masjid, what started to happen was that the people in the underworld also started to be drawn into this kind of differentiation. So you started to see splits in the underworld along religious affiliation where they had never existed before. So that in the book itself, Ganesh Gaitonde, who at the beginning of the novel thinks of himself as a secular man who actually doesn't believe in God at all, slowly gets drawn into participating in a collusion with the Hindu right until he actually starts referring himself to himself as the Hindu Don. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the unfortunate aspects of this kind of religious polarization, that it extends through a culture and society until it gets to every corner. I think in reality now, even though that schism happened and there was this kind of polarization, what I'm seeing now is that more and more people are again coming together and working together in the underworld, which I'm not saying is necessarily a happy thing for the rest of us. I think finally in the underworld, the great God is money, right, and power. So as long as you're making cash and you have access to what the kinds of power that you need, you're willing to collaborate with somebody else. But again, I mean, what I will say is that yes, it did happen, but I think it's a reflection of a larger polarization that I think exists in the country and perhaps the world today.
So those lines getting drawn, kind of radicalism coming into what was a secular criminal realm. Nasser, in Boston, thanks for your call. Brian's calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, Brian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am a big fan of Bombay cinema. I frequent many of the movies, and I meet many of the people who are Indian or Hindi afterwards, and I tell them I don't know a stitch of it. Most of them are subtitled, thankfully, but I'll even go to some of the others. And I was wondering, what is the intersection between some of the Bollywood Bombay cinema and this book? My suspicion is that it might be the humanity, because the book sounds like it's full of realism, whereas much of what I enjoy in some of these cinema things is the fantasy of these movies, but yet I look for the realism of the humanity. So I'm wondering if perhaps the author might be able to comment on that.
That's great, Brian. Let us pick it up. And Vikram Chandra, I should say, I mean, you've got a lot of family ties into the Indian film community. Your mother, Kamna Chandra, a screenwriter. Your sister, youngest sister, a well-known film critic there. Brother-in-law, Vidhu Vinod Chopra, a director there. Brian says, you know, what about the intersections of Bollywood and all the rest you've laid out?
Well, I have to thank Brian for that great phrase where he said the realism of the humanity. I might steal that with his permission and use it, because I think that's what is wonderful about that cinema, is that it's larger than life, it's huge in its emotions, and I guess to the uneducated eye, the eye that is not familiar with it, it seems melodramatic. But what it catches really accurately and profoundly is the emotions that live in all of our hearts. And I think it's for this reason that, and I don't know how many American viewers will know about this, it's hugely popular across Africa, in the Middle East, mm-hmm. in what used to be the old Soviet Union. I once had an Italian waiter from a small village in Sicily, in a restaurant in Detroit, suddenly start singing a song at me from a Hindi film.
And it's spreading. So, my kid's watching Bride and Prejudice recently.
Right, right. So in India, what happens is that it is a part of our everyday lives. So if I'm walking down a street, I'll hear a radio from one shop playing one song, and then I'll turn the corner and a car will pass by and somebody else will be playing another song from there. I think the role that it plays, the music that is in our lives, is perhaps analogous to what rock and roll does in the United States. I can hear certain songs and they instantly take me back to a certain point in my life. The cinema also is really important in Indian culture in general, because it becomes a kind of national conversation about who we are, what we're becoming, and where we're going. So you can see many of the contemporary sort of problems addressed. And often the commercial cinema, especially the bigger films, will play it very safe, as big films always do. But still, the problems are brought up. So in this book, everyone sings songs from these movies. Mm. It's a constant part of the texture of their world. Ganesh Gaitonde actually then ends up getting involved in this film industry itself, as is the case in reality. Unfortunately,
in reality, meaning you're saying gangsters have their money in Bollywood,
right? And especially, I mean, this was more true a few years ago. The government only very recently recognized the film industry as a legitimate industry. So before that, you couldn't actually get a bank loan to make a film. So there were these people called financiers who gave you your loans at very high rates of interest, and you never knew where that money was coming from.
And don't ask.
Don't ask. Yeah. And some of them were very, the underworld types were very directly involved in production of movies. So Ganesh Gaitonde actually in this becomes a filmmaker who makes a film that he hopes, that he's very eager to get involved in, because in a sense it's a retelling, as he sees it, of his own epic life.
As if Al Capone ran Hollywood here or had a piece of it.
Exactly. And he puts his girlfriend in it, of course. You know?
Of course, of course. You know, I wanted to ask you, off of Brian's question, I was reading Pankaj Mishra's review of the book in The New Yorker. She talks about you've been quoted saying that, that not only the novel, but our sort of sense of self is different between East and West, or may come to be. She quotes you saying that you think Indians pull between tradition and modernity in a chaotically populous and poor country have a less psychologically inhibited sense of self and a mythic rather than a historical sense of their place in the world. I wish you'd unpack that for us. It's fascinating, right. But what does it mean?
I started thinking about this a few years back when I read a book, and of course I'm going to forget the name now that I should remember it. It was a book by a psychiatrist who was practicing in New York in the early 70s, and he started to get, at that point with the increasing immigration from the subcontinent, some patients who were from the subcontinent. And what he found was that his usual techniques didn't actually work with these people, that he found himself sort of floundering because he would ask a question and he couldn't work out or parse the answer.
Because their heart's reference was in a different place from his Western patients? What was it?
Right, right. So that the sense of how the self is constructed, for instance, in the West, you know, as a unitary object that is separate from other people might actually be different from the way that somebody else conceives of himself in a village in South India, for instance, where you're much more connected with your family and your community, and your sense of who you are is, it sort of flows between you and the people around you.
And the mythic, though, what is that? Is that in reference to the sort of pantheon of gods and religious stories rather than historical developments as the reference point for self-understanding?
Yeah, well, I think there was actually a moment that crystallized this. I met what is called a shooter, one of the gunmen for one of these companies in Bombay. And he was an interesting young man in his early 20s who described himself as a vegetarian yoga-doing hitman.
Okay.
And I tried to, you know, present him with questions quite carefully. And so at one point in the afternoon that I spent with him, I asked, so how do you justify what it is that you do? I mean, you know, you're given a job and you're told out to go and kill someone that you don't know, you have nothing against this person. And he looked at me and he pointed up and he said, well, the way it works is that man's death is already written by him, you know, H in uppercase pointing upwards.
Yes.
And I'm just playing a part in the play. And he was being very clever and philosophically slippery. He was trying to justify what he was doing on the basis of a very old Indian idea that in a sense, we play these parts in the Lord's play. In a sense, in a larger universe, a mythic universe that has its own constructions and its own rules. But I think in some sense, people do see themselves in that context, meaning that their life is not limited to the very individual and the specific of here and now, but it's also connected to something much larger, a dharma, as it were, a story that is much larger than themselves.
That gets ratcheted up to very high stakes in Sacred Games when you've got the guru character here
with his
fingers on a kind of nuclear bomb, talking to one of his followers, saying, "What is sacrificed is you. You must die so that the universe may live," and everything is on the table at that point. Let me get a call from Tyler in Dedham, Massachusetts. Hi, Tyler. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Vikram.
I read
the book. I bought it when I was in England, and there was no glossary at that time in the book. I had to print it off of the internet.
Right.
And I just wanted to say something. I wanted to say, first of all, that I loved the book, and I couldn't put it down. I also wanted to say that I'm an English teacher who's been teaching for about 35 or 40 years, and it took me back to reading in a way that I don't think I've probably had to read since I was about 12 or 13 years old because of the language in the book, which was the Hindi and the whatever the other language is that's in there. And the glossary didn't do it for me. I mean, the glossary, I would look things up, and I realized I was so slowed down that I wasn't going to be able to comprehend the book or the plot of the book and the ideas in the book. And so as a result, I just put the glossary aside, and I read, and I don't know that I know very many words as I finished the book, but it was comprehensible and wonderful, and thank you so much.
You went with the flow. So you weren't cursing, Vikram, as you read through all that. It finally, you just went with it, Tyler.
I just went with it. It took me about 50 pages just to let it go, because there's a lot about food and clothes that's just not covered in the glossary. And I decided it doesn't matter whether they're eating fish or they're eating something else or what kind of fish they're eating. I'll just go with it.
You're the English teacher, Tyler. Let me go to you with this idea that this storytelling style, as Pankaj Mishra described it, goes from documentary naturalism to an epic mode of storytelling without getting bogged down in psychological realism, a kind of reference to the mythic rather than the real at so many points. Did you feel that? Did you read that, Tyler?
I think I did. I mean, I hear the allusion to Crime and Punishment, something like
that,
where you're carried. Of course, that has a lot of psychological analysis too, but where you're carried partially by the plot, but you're also you're really carried by the ideas too. The idea that the guru, for example, is trying to do some kind of nuclear war. It just kind of blows me away. But I didn't get bogged down in any way, shape, or form by it.
It's terrific. Tyler, thanks for calling. Vikram Chandra, what about the glossary and all the Indian language that's woven through here? Is that because you were writing it for an Indian audience, or because it's time for the world just to sort of learn a little or go with the flow? How do you see it?
Well, I should say thank you to Tyler. It's very encouraging to hear that that an American reader would actually look at this and treat it in that way. My hope is, despite the glossary being at the back, that people will just read it. And her mention of childhood takes me back to the time that I was a kid in India reading British children's tales, right? Mm-hmm. And I would wonder, you know, what is a crumpet and how can these people eat clotted cream? It made absolutely no sense.
Right.
But I think what happens is that that precisely, that not knowing, becomes part of the pleasure of encountering art from another part of the world, of figuring out its nuances and its subtleties. So in terms of my intent, like I said, I just wanted to use the English that is Indian, the English that we actually use and every day in India, in order to bring alive this very Indian reality. And at that point in the writing itself, I wasn't thinking, you know, of any viewer, any reader outside of my immediate context. I guess my imagined reader would be part of a very small group of friends and family who live in Bombay and share with me that language and that universe of cultural reference. But I think, I mean, as an Indian, I'm used to doing this. I look out at the world. You know, if I read a novel by an American writer from Arizona, you know, I have to figure out what a Pueblo is or why they go to Circle K to get a bottle of milk.
and off we go. But we figure it out. At one point, you've got your arch villain, Gaitonde, saying to the police inspector, Sartaj Singh, this is near the end of Gaitonde's life, "It is a game, my friend. It is only a game. It is Leela." And whether we know it or not, we kind of get the idea that that's the cosmic game. Let's go to Phillipsburg, Montana, and Scott. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question about India and China's relationship. They're moving
India together. And China, you say, Scott?
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. As they're moving forward so quickly, I mean, both their economies just expanding at exponential rates, how do you feel that relationship will grow, and how will those cultures be affected as we move forward in a new, more globalized world?
Mm, Scott, thanks for your call. Vikram Chandra, there you are, citizen of India, but lumped with China from Americans looking at your hemisphere rising. What do you say?
That's a very large question, and suddenly I feel like putting on my political pundit hat.
The greatest game on here. What do you say?
Right. Well, I think, I mean, from where I'm standing, there's a couple of things that come to mind. One is that people in India, and this actually, a couple of the characters in the book actually talk about this, is that as this development increases and goes on, some people in India look at China with a kind of envy because of the ability to implement autocratic change. So, for instance, in Bombay, the local trains on which millions of people depend to get to their livelihoods every day actually run at 40% of their rated speed. And the reason for that is that there are slums built along every inch of the rail tracks. Mm-hmm. And so there are people and kids playing, you know, right next to the tracks. Now, anywhere else in the world, or perhaps in China at least, you would just clear the slums off. Mm. But since India is a democracy, some politicians seize the people who live in those slums as votes. And the minute the municipality trucks show up to try and clear the tracks, somebody else, the politician, will show up and stop it from happening.
But that's your country, your culture.
Exactly. So it's the messiness of democracy and the messiness of Indian culture itself, which at this point I think some of us see as frustrating, so that when you hear about, you know, in Shanghai, they're knocking down 300-year-old neighborhoods to build skyscrapers, people think, why can't we be that efficient? Mm. But I think what's going to be interesting in the long run to watch is whether democracy works better or whether that other system actually starts to maybe creak at the seams and break because it can't hold in. Development brings with it a whole host of other problems, individualism, people wanting freedoms and so forth. So that's the paradox that I'm really interested in, I think, watching over the next 10 or 20 years, what's going to happen.
We've just got half a minute, Vikram Chandra. Give us one definition before you go, this Leela. Have we got it right? The title is Sacred Games. Leela means?
The Lord's play. The illusion, the mystical, lovely, beautiful game that we see all around us, that we are part of, that we participate in.
Vikram Chandra, unfolding it with gangsters and police and a lot more in Mumbai. It's been great speaking with you today. The new book is Sacred Games. Vikram Chandra, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.